The thing around your neck is published on the 2nd of April, and I will suddenly find out the publisher by 4th Estate. Despite the Korean satellite launch this weekend, the norm in warfare now is insurgency and counterinsurgency. Think Iraq or Afghanistan, Ireland or Pakistan. So it should surprise nobody that guides to insurgency are published. What I didn't know is there's a long history to such counterinsurgency manuals, and that Michael Burgoyne and Albert Marquardt's The Defense of Jos Al-Daria, a manual based on their military experience in Iraq, should take as its starting point E.D. Swinton's The Defense of Duffer's Drift, written by a British captain during the Boer insurgency in South Africa in 1905. In both books, the main character has six dreams in which he lives an attack by insurgents, each time improving his sense of what needs to be done to win, not lose, stay alive, not die, win the hearts and minds of locals, not make them enemies. To talk about these manuals, I'm joined by one of the authors, Michael Burgoyne, and by defence analyst Paul Beaver. Michael, reading this book, reading your manual, I kept thinking writing for you is a different matter, because if you write badly, you could end up killing people, or having people killed.
And that's absolutely true. It was interesting to write it, because when we were writing it, we were actually starting to do the new counterinsurgency doctrine. FM 324, the field manual that the Army came out with, that General Petraeus kind of headed up, kind of put forth the U.S. Army's effort on how we're going to conduct counterinsurgency. And when we were writing this book, The Defense of Jisr al-Daria, Jim Marquardt, Albert Marquardt, was in Iraq conducting operations while I was back training soldiers to go in the desert out at NTC, the National Training Center. So he was literally conducting counterinsurgency with his soldiers, with the real-life things that were going on. I had been there before. But we fully understood, you know, if we don't do this right, you know, soldiers could get hurt and civilians could get hurt. And then beyond that, if we didn't do something, then we were going to continue to see the same kind of learning curve that we'd seen before. With our leaders.
One of the things that surprised me, I mean, this is published very recently, which means inevitably that you have the horrendous mistakes which America committed in Iraq, or at least that's how they can be seen, for 5 years to work on. I'm interested in a sense how you write this book. Do you write it by asking other military people who've committed these errors?
We didn't necessarily. I mean, it's difficult. War is always very difficult. And we've already talked about uncertainty on the program today. Counterinsurgency, warfare in general, is complete uncertainty. You never know if you're going to be successful or not, or what exactly you're going to encounter. So we've had, you could call them horrendous errors, but no matter what war you go into, you're going to have lots of problems. The issue that we wanted to really talk about here was, how do you adapt? How do you get better? How do you become successful in a situation you weren't prepared for? And junior leaders that I saw coming through the National Training Center didn't have some of the baseline knowledge that they needed, didn't have the ideas on, I'm encountering something new, how do I learn from this, how do I adjust, what are some of the tenets, some of the fundamentals that I would need to be successful?
Let me ask you about one of them. I mean, let me just say I found the book kind of gripping at one kind of level, but I was surprised that you had to tell people that they needed somebody who could speak Arabic. It would seem to me such a kind of baseline issue that if you're going to go into a country, you need somebody who can speak it.
Right, absolutely. And there's several things that seem like they would be just so obvious on the surface. And yet, coming out of Vietnam, the United States Army, we didn't necessarily embrace a lot of this counterinsurgency doctrine. It seemed like it kind of went away.
Do you know why?
Well, there's several books about why we kind of turned away from that and how that happened. But I think just overall, it's more about, you know, how do we learn now, and how do we make sure that the stuff that we're learning now, that any mistakes or any learning points that we've learned the hard way are things that are retained. And part of the book is, our goal was that junior leaders get this. And beyond just junior leaders in the Army, I've had several encounters with people without military experience. And if you just watch the news and just see things on TV, you often wonder, you've got two different sides. We have all this technology, why can't we just win this? What's the problem? And then you've got other people that are saying, you know, we're just over there, you know, committing, you know, all kinds of atrocities and causing all kinds of problems. And it's really not the case. I mean, it's just that this is so hard, it's so difficult, and it's so complex.
Okay, give me one example. I've given the listeners one example, which is have someone who can speak Arabic. Give me another example of that kind of learning curve.
Well, the language, obviously, the culture. There's a lot of different things with the culture as far as specifics. And when in the book we talk about, there's one kind of amusing example where they bring out, you know, a cook, a boiled sheep's head. You know, and I've been to meetings with sheikhs and local leaders where they bring out food, and they have these things that they do, and the men, you know, kiss when they greet each other. And for an American, we know we're hands off all the time. We keep an arm's distance from everyone, especially I'm from the West. So those things for me were completely foreign, and I had to really just say, okay, this is what I need to do. I need to embrace this and figure this out. But it is a steep learning curve to kind of understand how complex, especially in Iraqi society, and Afghan society is the same. How those things work together, how tribalism works with the government, how those relationships function.
Okay. I wonder, Broden, if we can bring Paul Beaver in here. Paul, let's put aside this particular manual. Do you think counterinsurgency manuals work? In other words, let's take the Brits in Basra. Did our manuals work there?
They did for a while. The problem that we had in Basra was that we were very complacent. We'd had very successful counterinsurgency campaigns in Malaya in the 50s and 60s, in confrontation with Indonesia and Borneo. We considered ourselves to be the masters. We were, I'm afraid, a little bit sort of looking down upon the Americans. What has impressed the British about the Americans is, yes, they made a lot of mistakes from 2003 to about 2006. And then along came General Petraeus, and he made the Americans learn. And actually, they've learned quicker than we have. We know more about Afghanistan. After all, we fought three wars there before. My grandfather fought in the third Afghan War.
I was going to say, the Britons have been failing in Afghanistan for a long time.
Well, we sort of lost two and drew one. And it's a sort of, you know, not exactly a brilliant success rate. If it were in a football team, you'd have fired the manager by now. But I think that the key to this is we learn lessons and then we forget them.
Well, I want to pick this up because, Michael, you sidestepped the question I asked. You know, Vietnam is a kind of shadow over American history, you know, and yet the counterinsurgency errors in Vietnam, do you know what I mean, were forgotten. I still want to know why.
Well, you could say that, you know, we didn't necessarily like, if you read John Noggle's book, Learn to Eat Soup with a Knife, it's a great book that compares the British experience in Malaya and the United States experience in Vietnam. And he talks about his idea is that basically we went away from the lessons that we learned, because it wasn't just failures in Vietnam. There were many successes. There were many programs that functioned. But because of the state of the army afterwards, we needed something to focus on. And the thing we focused on was high-intensity conflict. And airland battle.
Called the Star Wars scenario.
Right, lots of technology, lots of air power, focusing on the large-scale Soviet conventional threat. And that, to a certain extent, saved the army. And so it's very easy to blame everyone for, hey, why didn't you take these lessons and make this part of everything that we did? But the state of the army was in, they needed to get some focus. So they really turned that army into a world-class force. And then you saw in Desert Storm how successful that was. But part of the reason for this book and some of the stuff we're doing, the learning we're doing now, is to make sure we have a broader capability, you know, so that, because the army isn't entitled to decide what types of wars it's allowed to fight. The country and the government decide that. So we need to have a capability to work across the spectrum. Now, there's a large debate on what capability needs to be more important and how we do that.
Paul?
Exactly. In the same way in the United Kingdom, we're trying to decide whether we're going to fight and win a war or the war being Afghanistan, a war being something that might happen in 2020, 2025. And your real problem if you're a government is where do you invest your money? And we don't do technology quite in the same way as the United States does. We rely a lot more on the people. I mean, something that came out of Northern Ireland was it was called the Corporal's War, because a corporal could make a decision on the streets that was world headlines within an hour. All he had to do was get his section to open fire on a group of demonstrators, and around the world it would be condemned. And we learned a lot from that. We learned to trust our NCOs, something the Americans didn't do, I don't think, until recently. Now you're beginning to do the same, your junior leader ideas, which in fact we've stopped doing. So, you know, these things go in circles, Philip. This is the thing.
Well, let me pick this up. What I'm interested in is, you know, I'm a corporal. I'm an NCO in the battlefield, which is terrifying even for the most professionalized of soldiers. And I have this manual, which I remember reading at West Point, or if I'm a non-commissioned officer, definitely not at West Point, but somewhere else. And I suppose what I'm wondering is, the gap between the life of the manual and the life of the body when it's in a war zone. I mean, how do you navigate that, Michael?
I mean, the difference between what they learn in the book and in reality. This book is actually designed as kind of a gateway, because you don't see a lot of sergeants, and everyone's very busy. You don't see a lot of lieutenants picking up a book and saying, I'm going to, or even civilians for that matter, picking up a book and saying, I'm going to read 500 pages of 324. It's daunting. So we created something very simple. It's a starting point. So from this, they can go read Galula. They can go read John Noggle. They can read the 324, and they have a better understanding. And if they're getting ready to get on a plane to go into theater, they could read this book on the plane. And it gives them more like a framework, some lanes to operate within, because no matter where you go, the environment's going to be different. So you can't answer all the questions. There's no steadfast rules.
Okay, and still, how do you discipline yourself to follow the manual rather than to follow kind of what the culture of any particular moment insists upon?
I don't think you do follow the manual per se. I mean, that's something that we used to criticize the Soviets for, that they could only operate an operational maneuver group by turning left at that obstacle or turning right at that one. What we try to do in the British Army is quite different. We try to teach people to have an agile mind, to read the manual, certainly, to go to the classes, but actually then to apply that on the ground. So you're trying to apply the theory to the ground. It's the same in every walk of life, I'm sure. But it really is a matter of making people think and be flexible, rather than just say, oh, there's a village, if I'm going to go around this village, I have to do it this way, or I have to bring that many helicopters or that many tanks.
Michael, and quite briefly as we come to the end, this counterinsurgency pamphlet, in a sense, is about winning a war rather than a battle. Okay, in other words, it's a long-term aim.
Right.
What I'm really interested in is the tension, the contradictions between immediate needs for winning battles and the long-term benefits of winning wars.
Right, and it's interesting because it seems like that's one of the hardest conflicts in counterinsurgency, because especially when you're a soldier, American soldier, you have so much firepower, you have so much capability, and there's a tendency to go to this war is a war is a war method, where this village is causing me problems. I just need to wipe this thing out, and there goes my problem. You know, I can just go through here and just arrest everyone in the village. I can go through. You can do that, but that doesn't win the war, like you're saying. So you have to understand sometimes the indirect method, sometimes doing nothing, sometimes doing something that's a little more creative, a little more innovative, and geared towards bettering the people that you're trying to protect or trying to work with, is the right way to do it. And that seems like the largest conflict.
Michael Burgoyne and Paul Beaver, both, thank you very much. And The Defense of Jisr al-Dawriya is published by the University of Chicago Press. Betrayals, rather an old...